Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on The Front Porch. This week we speak with an expert on the working class. Why, as a group, they dislike doctors, lawyers, and other professionals, but love billionaires like Donald Trump. I'm West Virginia Public Broadcasting Executive Director Scott Finn, along with Lori Lynn, and unfortunately, Rick Wilson, not here today. He has some sort of goat-related emergency.
It's always goat-related.
Which is too bad, because he'd love this conversation we're going to have with Joan C. Williams. She's the founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. Joan, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
What got you interested in this as a subject?
Well, I'm strictly a silver spoon girl. I grew up elite on both sides, but I married into a working class family nearly 40 years ago, and I study social inequality. I've studied social inequality for nearly 40 years, and unlike most people who do that, I don't just study gender or just study race. I study the complexity of the way that social inequality affects everyday interactions. And so I became extremely interested in social class, and specifically in the way that social class frames all of the things that we take for granted, kind of the water we swim in, and affects them in really, really profound ways that makes cross-class communications really challenging.
So in your article, you said you were not surprised by Donald Trump's success, and that what was driving it is the, quote, class culture gap. What's the class culture gap?
One key element of the class culture gap that's relevant to the election is that white working class folks tend to admire the very rich, but really resent professionals. They resent professionals because these are the people who are ordering them around every day, often disrespectfully. This is the college kid who comes in and gets the job ahead of you and tells you how to do the job you've been doing for 30 years. This is the doctor who treats you like an idiot or condescends to you, the teacher who condescends to you and communicates that she feels better than you because she has more of an education. So a tremendous amount of resentment of professionals. On the other hand, the rich, that's what the white working class would like to be. They don't want to make all of the cultural changes that would be required for them to become professional families. They just want to be exactly the way they are, living their lives the way they've always lived them, with the values they've always had, but with more money. And so in many ways, Hillary Clinton represented to, I think, many Trump voters, the sort of condescension of professionals, whereas Trump represented their dream of, like, be just like I am, be able to do not mess with that political correctness nonsense, say what you want to say, say it in a direct way, but with the freedom of being a billionaire.
What they want, then, what a lot of people want, is they want to have their same lives in the same way, but with more money. They saw in their parents, let's say, a certain way of life. The man is the breadwinner. The woman gets to stay home if she wants. And if they can't have exactly that, they're going to be upset. Well, that doesn't seem like – it doesn't seem very adult to me. That seems like almost like a childish reaction. I don't have to change. I don't want anything to be different. I just want more money. That doesn't seem like a very mature way of looking at the world. Am I being too harsh there?
I think you're just being elite there. I remember I was talking to one working class guy, and he said to me, I associate change with loss, he said. And I went like, whoa, ain't that the truth? That's the attraction of stability, because change typically means loss. And that's what this whole class of people has seen over the past 20, 30, 40 years. Change has meant loss. And so I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who lives in Georgia. She was saying, you know, what these people really are saying is that there's a whole lot of people here in the South who they had the three-bedroom home with the two baths, cinder block, very, very modest home, and they had a full-time jobs, and they didn't do anything wrong, and now they're losing all of it. That does not strike me as whining. That strikes me as, I mean, you know, here I am, old-time leftist, an exploited group, furious that they were given so little, they were satisfied with that little. And now that little is being taken away. These people aren't whining. These people are in pain because they had, for two short generations, they could live stable middle-class lives, and now they're losing that. We need to listen to this.
Well, I get that, and I am playing devil's advocate here a little bit, but I want to push this just a little bit farther. I'm assuming that unless the laws of the world change in a substantial way, these trends that require people to have more education in order to have a decent life, I don't see them going the other way.
We have approached it with utter class cluelessness. We have said, if you want a stable life, get a college education, because, you know, that's what worked for me. We keep saying to them, either you get a really good college education and become like us, or you're lazy, unambitious, and just whining that you wanted your father's life. No, no, we need to offer them something that's realistic for them. There was actually a study coming out from the Center for American Progress, which, as you know, is the kind of the Democrats' think tank in Washington, that showed that going to college, in many ways, economically, doesn't make a whole lot, heck of a lot of sense for many kids in this class. We need to offer them something other than a really, really dead-end job at minimum wage.
Joan, we seem to have become so much more irritated with each other on each side of this educated working class fault line. And I wonder if social media is playing a role in that at all. I mean, are we kind of in each other's face more, and does that make it worse?
You know, I think you're asking important questions, and I think the level of polarity has really, I mean, there's been studies that sharply increased in the United States such that people don't care if their kids marry somebody of a different race, but they really care if their kids marry someone of a different party. And people are much, much less likely to have friends from a different party than they were in past decades. Is it the problem that we're in each other's face more, or is it the problem that we have these hysterical echo chambers? As hysterical, I might add, on the left as on the right. I was talking to a young woman after Trump was elected who was just beside herself saying, oh, you know, I and my kids are going to end up in internment camps. And there's just on both sides, there are these echo chambers.
Here's the other thing that has to be asked. You say that people should avoid the temptation to write off blue-collar resentment as racism. Other people would say that they believe Donald Trump said things that were xenophobic, racist, and by voting for him, at the very least, they're tolerating that sort of sentiment. How do you respond to that?
I think it's complicated. I think Donald Trump certainly used open racism in his campaign. In the 10 days after the election, there were over 800 hate incidents. So he has certainly legitimized a level of racism and misogyny and xenophobia that is just so profoundly upsetting. All of that is true. On the other hand, to write off sort of the cri de coeur of the white working class as this is beneath our notice because it's mere racism, you know, that's dangerous because it isn't mere racism. These people have a profound pain that we need to address, or else we're going to see a lot more Timothy McVeighs in the future regardless, because, you know, Trump ain't going to deliver for them. I mean, that's not going to happen. So I also think that in many ways, we on the left have made racism truly delicious, and misogyny too. And the way we have is by defining our coalition as women, people of color, LGBT+, the disabled, all of those, the poor, all of those people. We spend a lot of time using our imaginations to understand why they do what they do, what their sources of social pain are. We spend a lot of time working for justice for them, and we don't for the white working class. The white working class are just stupid racists with bad taste. Shame on us for creating a coalition that leaves out one of a key disenfranchised group. If we do that, isn't it pretty inevitable that a beautiful stick in the eye to the elite will be calling a white professional woman, saying a white professional woman, you had blood coming out of your whatever? At that point, racism and misogyny becomes a way to poke the elite in the eye. Now, if we had created a coalition that included the white working class in the first place, you better believe that that would not feel so delicious. That would feel like, wait a minute, these people are standing up for me. I'm not going to stand by and let people in my coalition be insulted. Is it wise to write off the white working class as beneath our notice just because they are racist? No, that's really, really dangerous.
You talk about this coalition that would include, you know, the traditional Democratic groups and the white working class. But isn't that a really tough needle to thread, though, today? I mean, you mentioned the transgender bathroom issue in your piece. LGBT folks are a big part of the Democratic coalition, and the transgender and along with gay marriage are big issues. That is a very difficult sell, I think, especially the transgender bathrooms. We've talked about that here in West Virginia, to the white working class. How do you walk that line?
I mean, all through the 80s and 90s, we had a coalition that stood for racial justice and LGBTQ issues. And you know what? A huge number of blacks were really, really pretty homophobic. We managed that. We can manage it again. You don't create a coalition by creating a mind meld. You create a coalition by creating a win-win. And we can do that.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more on the working class from Joan Williams, founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California. But first, you're listening to The Front Porch for these in-depth conversations about our culture, our history. Whether you live in West Virginia or are part of the worldwide hillbilly diaspora, we depend on you to make this podcast possible, along with our education programs, Mountain Stage, Inside Appalachia, the list goes on and on. So I'm asking you to think about becoming a sustaining member of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I tell you, when I see that gift coming out of my bank account, I feel pride, and I think you will too. So here's how you become a sustaining member. You go to wvpublic.org and click the donate button in the upper right-hand corner. That's wvpublic.org, click donate, and feel good about yourself. Thanks. Okay, we're back, and we're talking about the working class with Joan Williams, founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California.
Joan, I've done some reading recently about working class people and their attitudes toward their kids going away to college, for example, and how there's some ambivalence about that, right? Because like you were just saying, if the goal is to not change, you know, you send your kids away to college and they come back and they're talking different and they're eating different foods and they're, you know, passing judgment on your lifestyle.
When upper middle class kids go to college, they are just reproducing what's called the class location that they grew up in. They know how to eat, they know how to talk, they know how to dress, they know how to interact with people socially around issues related to not only gender and race, but also expression of emotion. And when working class kids go, particularly to elite colleges, they have a really hard choice. Are they going to change in all of those cultural ways that are really profound, like going to things as basic as, do you engage in a lot of self-reflection and talk through your feelings, talk out your feelings? That's very, very characteristic in the elite. That's part of being a good person in the elite. Among white workers, that's not part of being a good person. That's part of being kind of weird and self-obsessed and off-putting. And so these working class kids go to college and they have to decide whether to become what I call class migrants and basically go over to the ways of the elite. And if they do, and many of the successful ones do, they're in a completely different situation than elite kids are, because now their families are simultaneously proud of them, but also feel deeply rejected by them. The kids feel some of the resentment that the working class family feels against professionals. And it just, it's a really painful, painful, painful relationship.
Is fascinating to us. I mean, living it in West Virginia, and I grew up in what I would consider a working class household too, went to an elite school. But my parents, I never sensed that reluctance, or they hid it really well. I mean, they were just enthusiastic. They wanted us to get the education they could never get. I imagine these things are complicated, and it probably depends on your family and your situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
I come from a family of, you know, my parents were college educated, but I went to an elite school, and I would come home and there would be food that I had eaten, you know, and I wanted my mom to have hummus. And she was like, what is hummus? I developed a taste for avocados. I'd never eaten an avocado until I went to college. And, you know, my mother doesn't know a thing about avocado. She wouldn't know how to open an avocado.
So my wife comes home from college. She's a first generation college student, too. And they're going to the grocery store, and she wants to get slow cook rice, right? Because she's had it, thinks it tastes better. And her mom says, if you want to waste 20 minutes of your life cooking rice, you go right ahead. I'm grabbing the minute rice.
Food is one of those key class markers in a way that, I actually once wrote about, gave a talk about the class structure of coffee. When I was growing up, there was no class structure of coffee. You made coffee and you drank coffee, and that was it. Now there's this incredibly intricate class structure of coffee where about, 20, 30 years ago, Starbucks came in and all of a sudden nobody wanted to drink ordinary working man's coffee. You needed Starbucks coffee. And then Starbucks got really big, and then Starbucks became pretty down market for the elite, and that you needed to have the homegrown coffee shop. And now I just heard that Starbucks just introduced an elite little brand within Starbucks where you can get a $12 cup of coffee. But people, different classes use food to accomplish different goals. So the elite, it's always what's new, what's hot, what's sophisticated, how can I signal sophistication, knowledge of the world. So the dinner party is a good example of that. What do you do for the dinner party? You make everything from all around the world, from scratch, from organic. That's one way of using food. It's a way of using food to signal sophistication and give what I call a class act, sort of enacting elite status. In working class families, that's just not the way they use food. They use food to signal comfort. Large portions of simple, everyday food. So the fact that you would come home and be introducing all of these exotic foods into a working class household, and that can create tension, because all of a sudden you're using food to signal different social meanings than you were brought up with.
One of the big social meanings of food that I was brought up with was, even, you know, in addition to the comfort and kind of analogous to that, the idea that this is a family recipe, transmitting stories about your family. You know, I'm making this just the way your grandmother made it. I'm making it the way I made it for you when you were younger, the way we do every Christmas. There's a lot more tradition imbued with it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, the idea of reproducing tradition and enacting stability, there's such a really, one of the really big chasms in the white working class is the chasm between settled living and hard living. If you've read Hillbilly Elegy, I mean, his mother's family, the family that he grew up in, that was a hard-living family. I mean, they, you know, the mother had all kinds of substance abuse problems. She, you know, had problems keeping it together in four ways to Tuesday. But his father's family was a settled living family. They were very religious. They were very big on self-discipline. I pretty much guarantee you they were exactly focused on transmitting tradition and correctness. And that is really the central logic of white working class life is this dichotomy between hard living and settled living. And the transmission of tradition is so, so important that ways of doing things that are different. I mean, I'll just tell a story here. When I was an early married life, my parents-in-law were visiting, and this was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My husband and I were going to Harvard. It was the whole class migrant thing. And Ruth was helping us clean up, and she said, she was asking a million questions, and then she asked, "Where do you keep the butter?" And without thinking, I said, "Under the bed." And she went and put it under the bed.
You were joking, right?
Oh, yes, I was joking. It was a bit of a mean joke, yeah. I mean, that's how weird an animal I was to her. Like, I didn't do things correctly, and God knows how I did them. So maybe I kept butter under the bed. I mean, that's the class culture gap.
I want to ask you about a couple more fascinating things that your research and your article went into, which actually ring really true for me living here. One is that people misunderstand that the working class does not mean poor. Those two things are very different, and there are different levels of poverty too. There's working poor, there's people who don't work at all. Talk about that distinction. Why don't liberals understand the difference?
Because when liberals talk about working class, they're typically thinking about the bottom 30% of American families. When I'm talking about working class, I'm talking about people in the middle. The middle 50% of American families, median income in 2008, $64,000. Those are really, really, really different groups. And liberals literally kind of, you'd say, oh, well, we have policies for the working class, minimum wage of $15 an hour. That's not a policy for the middle class. That's a policy for the poor, for the bottom 30% of American families, and a damn important policy it is for them. But it is not going to appeal to these people who we're now calling working class again in common parlance. What we're really talking about here is the middle class. We're talking about the middle 50%. And the only reason it's really confusing is that the professional elite calls itself middle class because they look up to the truly rich and they go, oh, I'm just middle class.
I think in a lot of ways, you know, we've gone from a society where we've got status through our race or through our gender, and we've moved away from that in many ways, and that's a great thing. But we've kind of replaced that with education. And so now what we say to people is, you are on the lower tier from me because you're not educated. And that, you know, makes it your fault in a way that race or gender never was.
Yeah.
Another thing I notice here is you look at what's going on college campuses and, you know, this kind of idea that you gain status by being a victim of something. I think that's really tough for people, especially here in Appalachia, where we have such an honor culture and, you know, no one from that culture wants to be a victim. And so, you know, you send your kid away from college and all of a sudden they're coming home talking about how exploited they are. And this gives them status. And you're saying, what, you know, what? It's completely foreign.
Yeah, yeah. In Appalachia, you do have the culture of honor. But in the American working class more generally, one of the most famous, the single best book about class in America is called The Dignity of Working Men. Dignity is like a huge issue. Dignity, independence. So the idea that you're a victim, I mean, I was talking to a colleague of mine, in fact, and he was saying, well, you know, maybe we really have to be more empathetic and really lift these people up. And I'm going like, hey, that language ain't going to work for them. That language actually stems from the progressive era where you had the white elite lifting up the poor out of pure charity. That language is going to be perceived as condescending for a really simple little reason. It is condescending.
You talk about Trump's plan for coal versus Hillary Clinton's. Clinton wanted to continue the Clean Power Plan and Power Plus Plan, which is basically, look, the coal industry is going to shut down, and we're going to give a lot of aid to the coal fields to help you transition. That's their plan. And Trump comes in with a message that says, no, we want you to go back to work again. And it's not a surprise to us here that the let's go back to work again is the message people want, not something that sounds like charity.
Yeah, they want the dignity of independence. And you know what? So do I.
This storm that's hit Appalachia, job loss and unemployment and underemployment, if trends in automation continue, it seems like this storm is going to be hitting more and more Americans.
So long as we say there are two paths in the United States. Either you go to a good college and get a professional job, or you work at McDonald's for $7.25 an hour. That has been our industrial policy, with some exceptions, you know, major exception during the early Obama administration. But by and large, that's been our industrial policy for the past decade. If that continues in our industrial policy, yes, there is no way that rural America is going to be anything but going deeper and deeper into poverty. The question is, are we going to follow a model where we train people for jobs where they're delivering services that cannot be outsourced, interacting with robots, and they have the specific technical skills they need for those jobs, but they don't have a doctorate in sociology? It's just a failure of imagination, or, you know, it's actually just another example of the class culture gap. It's like, okay, we're going to build a middle-class America by giving everybody a doctorate in sociology. Excuse me, that's a dumb plan.
Do you think that elites in the Republican Party understand the white working class in the way that elites in the Democratic Party do not?
Actually, yeah, I do. It's really ironic, but I do. The Republican elite around the 70s said, oh, you know, we don't really understand why white working class cares about religion and tradition and stability, but we know they do, and so we're going to use that language because we need their vote, because we, as country club Republicans, can't win without them. So I don't know how deep the understanding is, but it's David, you know, who in the New York Times picked up my article? It was David Brooks. Not surprised.
So our goal here, one of our goals here, is to explain the world to West Virginia and explain West Virginia to the world. And West Virginia is an overwhelmingly working class state. What advice do you have for us in trying to do that?
The kind of conversation we've had today about the class culture gap, I think that's really, really important, so that we begin to build a shared conversation with the disenfranchised, rural, typically whites, and the progressive elite, so that they can understand each other and start to talk to each other in a way that signals mutual understanding and respect. So that's really important cultural work, and it's cultural work that radio is really well designed to do. I mean, we basically need what we had in the 1960s with respect to the poor, where we had the transition from speaking of understanding the poor as just lazy and stupid into understanding why they remained poor and what their culture was and what their values were and why they were really valuable things that they were offering to society culturally. That's the kind of thing that we've done really successfully with respect to race. Not to say that racism isn't around, but in terms of respect for black culture, we've made a lot of progress on that. In terms of respect for white working class culture, you know, other than Dolly Parton, who was, you know, now as old as me, we're pretty much close to an F minus. So that's a really important agenda that this kind of podcast can help further.
And that's The Front Porch. Special thanks to Joan Williams, founding director of the Center of Work-Life Law at the University of California. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Joan. Bye-bye.
Enjoyed the conversation. Bye-bye.
And thanks to Lori Lynn and you for listening. See you next week.